The Tablighi conclave in multi-ethnic Malaysia took place as the country was locked in a political showdown between a reformist, multiracial bloc and a conservative faction looking to increase the power of Malay Muslims. By the final day of the Tablighi gathering, a new prime minister had been sworn in, backed by a coalition including an Islamic party that has campaigned to turn Malaysia into an Islamic state. As Malaysian health officials tried to attack the spread of the coronavirus through the region, others in the political establishment were preoccupied with the unfolding leadership crisis. Tablighi participants were getting sick, but members of the new Malaysian government focused on damage control. Quote, "The likelihood of dying from the coronavirus was only 1%, while the possibility of dying at any moment is 100%, wrote Siti Zaila Muhammad Yusuf, the Deputy Minister for Women and Family Development, on Twitter. The Health Ministry initially said that 5,000 Malaysians had attended the Tablighi conference. Days later, the number was revised to about 14,500 Malaysians and 1,500 foreigners. Welcome to the Politics of Pandemics, Episode 8, Society of Preachers, Part 1. We've talked about the role of religion in the face of the recent pandemic in previous episodes before. On one hand, politicians and preachers have used religious faith to resist COVID mitigation measures. On the other, churches and religions being blamed for spreading the virus due to them gathering by the thousands. We're going to have a little bit of both for the next few episodes as I speak about a religious movement that was blamed for major COVID outbreaks in multiple countries at the start of the pandemic. This will be part one of a trilogy of episodes about a religious Muslim movement called the Tablighi Jamaah, who have tens of millions of followers across the world, primarily in South and Southeast Asia. Gatherings related to the movement were said to be the cause of thousands of COVID-19 cases in Malaysia, Pakistan, India, and hundreds of other adherents who traveled to these three countries. The different countries in the region reacted to the Tablighi Jamaah clusters happening in their respective countries in unique ways, related to the ongoing political factors happening in the country at the time. And given the subject of this miniseries deals with some heavy issues on racial and religious animus, I do want to say that I will try my best to be as respectful and fair as possible in talking about the different parties and governments involved. Sources are in the description as always, and you can send corrections to my Twitter account at polypandemicpod. If I cause any potential offense, I apologize for that. It was not my intention. For now, I just want to lay out the facts of what happened in one timeline and explain how we got where we are today. Like many other widespread religion, Islam has many schools of thought emerged over the years, and the Tablighi Jamaat was one such school. It is not an offshoot or a set organization, rather a specific way of thinking of the faith in a similar way evangelicals or Calvinists are schools of thought within Protestant Christianity. While it is little known outside of Islam, the Pew Research Center states that estimates of the number of its adherents range between 12 to 80 million people, and you can find followers in most countries around the world, although they tend to congregate the most in South and Southeast Asia. The Tablighi Jamaat movement was founded by Muhammad Ilyas Kandahawi in the 1920s, at the tail end of an Islamic revivalist movement happening in British India at the time. This is in reaction to what preachers like Ilyas saw as a slow loss of faith or a dilution of practices amongst Muslims living in India. As some of them converted from Hinduism to Islam, they retained some old Hindu practices like wearing the tilak or the mark on their foreheads. With Islam being diversified and the religion losing adherence to other religions like Christianity, Muhammad Ilyas advocated practicing Islam as the Prophet Muhammad did, in dress, customs, and personal behavior. For the adherents of the movements, this means eating food a certain way with your hands, sitting on the floor, wearing clothes a certain way, and keeping a specific type of facial hair, as the Prophet Muhammad apparently did. They are, of course, prohibited from participating in any non-Muslim rituals and festivities, and they also reject music and any secular arts, in line with their highly conservative beliefs. Nominally, the followers are encouraged to isolate themselves from impious society, and have specifically denied any involvement in political matters and Islamic jurisprudence, claiming they purely focus on study of Islamic scriptures and rituals. Like many other conservative Islamic organizations in Europe, Tablighi groups have worked to court the marginalized and the lost, especially immigrants who may feel sidelined by mainstream European society. However, the movement comes under a lot of fire from other Muslims, and a part of this stems from the proselytizing mission of the movement. Tablighi literally means to preach, and they have a strong focus of evangelizing their faith to others. But their focus, as per Muhammad Ilyas Kandahlavi's original intent, are not non-Muslims, but other Muslims and deconverts. This puts them at odds with other Islamic groups too, like the Salafis, both for approaching their members and from a philosophical and ideological perspective. They also purport a neutral stance when it comes to issues like the Palestine issue, which causes them to come under fire too from other Muslims who believe it is important for all of Islam to be in solidarity with the beleaguered state. What they may now be most known for, however, are the massive gatherings that can range into the millions. The largest ones are called Ijtema, or simply a major gathering or conference. It is an annual 3-day gathering where large groups of Tablighi male followers gather together, dedicate their lives to prayer and religion, live, eat, and sleep in a mosque. One such gathering, the Bishwa Ijtema, held outside Dhaka in Bangladesh, attracts up to 5 million visitors from all over the Islamic world. This is much larger than the 2 to 3 million people who perform the Hajj annually in Saudi Arabia. Smaller gatherings, relatively speaking, are held in various different places, but seem functionally similar in terms of activities. So you have a gathering of thousands of men sharing food, praying together, and sleeping in the same place for several days, which is the perfect recipe to spread COVID-19. The first of these to gain attention in this pandemic happened in Malaysia, at the Masjid Jamik Mosque in Sri Petaling, south of Kuala Lumpur, between February 27 and March 1st of 2020. For Malaysians, the first half of 2020 was not just memorable because of COVID and the lockdowns that followed it, but also the political crisis that occurred right before the number of COVID cases went up. Let us rewind a little to 2018. That year, the ruling Barisan Nasional, or National Front Coalition, which was at this point composed mostly of center-right nationalists, were defeated by a loose coalition of reformist parties for the first time in Malaysia's 61-year history. The sitting Prime Minister, Najib Razak, was accused of siphoning tens of billions of dollars from government coffers via the One Malaysia Development Berhad Corporation, a sovereign wealth fund. Malaysia's longest-serving Prime Minister, the 91-year-old Mahathir Mohamad, returned to serve as Prime Minister once again after 15 years, against his own party, building a cabinet that includes the politicians he once imprisoned for defying him 30 years ago. It was a monumental change that was also a tenuous one, due to Malaysia's parliamentary system and a history of party switching. The Pakatan Harapan, or the Coalition of Hope, was built with only one thing in mind, defeating the previous corrupt government, but the actual ideologies were all over the place, and it included many politicians who left the old government largely due to the 1MDB scandal, including the aforementioned Mahathir Mohamad. All it takes are a few sitting members of parliament to change side or a minor party to drop their support of the tenuous ruling coalition for the whole government to collapse. As the Prime Minister needs a majority of members of parliament in the House to remain as such, which is what happened in February 2020. When a handful of members of parliament dropped their support for Mahathir Mohamad and switched sides, Mahathir resigned accordingly and let parliament sort out who would become his successor. For a week at the end of February 2020, Malaysia had no government, no prime minister, and no cabinet. Another round of politically expedient but fragile coalitions were formed and broken until, on March 1st, Muhyiddin Yassin from the National Alliance Coalition gained the majority support to become prime minister. The National Alliance is a brand new coalition formed from the politicians who left the Coalition of Hope and was supported by the old Barisan National members, as well as a contingent of right-wing Islamic politicians. Without an election, the reformers lost, and the nationalists and Islamists returned to power. While this was all happening, COVID-19 was in Malaysia, but not yet a major issue. Up till February 28, 2020, there were 29 total cases of COVID-19 in the country, the overwhelming majority coming in from overseas. Malaysia was one of the countries affected by the SARS epidemic in 2004, and they were vigilant in trying to prevent COVID-19 from entering the country. Those measures, ironically, may have fostered a false sense of security within Malaysia. There were less stringent measures within the country, which is likely why the Tabligh gathering was allowed to go forward. Quote Reuters, on March 17, 2020, worshippers slept in packed tents outside the Golden Dome Mosque, waking before dawn to kneel on rows of prayer mats laid out in its cavernous central hall. All the while, the coronavirus was passing unnoticed amongst the guests. Attendees of the Tabligh gathering slept, washed, and prayed together for days, always in crowds, holding hands, and sharing food from each other's plates. Everyone eating with their right hand as per customary. To quote one attendee interviewed in the same Reuters article, holding hands at the religious ceremony was done with people of many countries. When I met people, I held hands. It was normal. I don't know who I was infected by. According to the Malaysian authorities, 16,000 people attended the event, including 1,500 international visitors from places like Nigeria, India, and Canada. This is despite Malaysia implementing restrictions on travel as a response to COVID-19, and many of these international attendees would return to their countries, where some were found to be positive with the virus. Also in this group were many from the Rohingya ethnic group who were Muslim refugees fleeing the military junta in Myanmar. While the new government initially tried to downplay the severity of the Tabligh outbreak, likely because of the overlap between their conservative Muslim support base and the Tablighi attendees, more and more cases were being traced back to the gathering, and not all the positive cases were attendees themselves, rather, second or third generation cases. On March 10th, after several weeks without a complete cabinet, the Prime Minister Muhyiddin Yassin appointed Dr. Adnan Baba as the Health Minister. And on March 11th, the authorities were looking to trace and test about 5,000 attendees, but by that time, many of the attendees had long since returned to their homes. Many returned to their home states outside of Kuala Lumpur or even their home countries. It became increasingly clear that 1. COVID-19 had spread amongst the thousands of people who attended the Tabligh gathering, and 2. Many of the attendees had spread the virus in their own home communities. With no choice and no other option to contain the virus, Malaysia entered a nationwide lockdown on March 16, a strict quarantine the Malaysian government called the Movement Control Order. Using contact tracing, the Malaysian authorities were able to isolate most of the cases originating from the Tabligh group. The Minister of Health used what I will call a cluster system where they trace the infection of the virus as they jump from person to person. A cluster grows until all positive persons are quarantined and the chain of infection is broken, ending the cluster when all parties recover or pass away. That's how they were able to track COVID-19 as husband infects wife, parents infect their children, and colleagues infect one another. At one point, the Tablet cluster and all its associated subclusters were responsible for as many as two-thirds of all the cases in Malaysia. Meanwhile, Malaysians went through an experience that has become depressingly familiar across the rest of the world. As part of the movement control order, everyone in Malaysia was forced to stay home, with only one person allowed out. Everyone worked from home if possible, and people were not allowed to travel more than 10 kilometers from their home. Police and military made sure everyone complied with the stay-at-home orders. And of course, with this forced quarantine comes blame. The change in government, occurring just as the tablet gathering occurred, allowed the current government to blame the last one for allowing it to go forward. In response, the last government claimed that they had COVID-19 under control, and the lack of government during a coup allowed COVID-19 to explode in March 2020. Of course, this he said, he said cycle doesn't really change the fact that hundreds of cases were being detected on a daily. Another unfortunate long-term consequence was the increase of xenophobia as a result of the new cases, specifically against the Rohingya community in Malaysia. Rohingyas are the largest stateless population on Earth, having fled Myanmar as a result of decades of persecution under the military junta. Malaysia is host to 100,000 Rohingyas, some having lived there for generations. Being Muslim, the Rohingyas felt that Malaysia was a safer place for them, and a small number of Rohingyas were among the attendees of the Tabligh conference in late February, along with thousands of local Malaysian Muslims and many foreigners. But the Rohingyas became the targets of vicious xenophobia and abuse from the very Muslims who once supported them in name of Islamic solidarity. There were signs demanding Rohingyas leave the apartments they were living in. Rohingyas living in Malaysia experienced a sudden rise in WhatsApp messages threatening them and telling them to return to, quote, their country. The Malaysian Navy turned away refugee boats where hundreds of Rohingya migrants were desperately trying to flee the unrest in Myanmar. The Air Force issued a statement saying, quote, with their poor settlements and living conditions, it is strongly feared that undocumented migrants who try to enter Malaysia, either by land or sea, will bring COVID-19 into the country. In one case, one boat with 396 refugees, including many women and children, had to be rescued by Bangladesh after reportedly being turned away from Malaysia twice and spending months stranded at sea. 32 people died. While Malaysia received a lot of criticism from international and domestic human rights observers for their inhuman treatment of the Rohingya community, the right-wing government enjoyed lots of support for its insular policy. They lumped the Rohingya refugees with other migrant workers and illegal immigrants, making no distinction between each group. Malaysia closed its borders to Rohingya refugees and made several high-profile immigration raids to weed out illegal immigrants. In a video from 2021, immigration officers were seen spraying captured legal immigrants with disinfectant in the same way one would spread pesticide on weeds. And when the Myanmar civil war heated up in February 2021, Malaysian authorities defied a court order and deported over 1,000 migrants back to the war-torn country. The Tablighi cluster was declared over on July 7, 2020, 4 weeks after the last new case was detected. Over 42,000 PCR tests were conducted, 3,375 positive cases of COVID-19 were confirmed. Of those, 1,037 actually attended the gathering, while the rest were infected either directly or indirectly. 34 had died by the time the cluster was declared finished. At the time, 40% of COVID-19 cases in Malaysia originated from the Kuala Lumpur Mosque, and cases were found in the farthest corners of Malaysia and in other countries as well. The end of the Tabligh cluster coincided with a loosening of restrictions and a reduction in the number of daily cases to single digits. While COVID-19 was still in Malaysia and clusters were showing up from time to time, Malaysians enjoyed a small reprieve from the pandemic and life returned to some level of normality for a few months. However, that sense of normality would be short-lived. And that's where I'll stop for now. There are many other stories regarding Malaysia I would like to cover, including the 2021 state of emergency, but at least for now, the impact of the Tabligh Jamaat gathering ended thanks to a strict movement control order and contact tracing of all positive cases. However, the right-wing government is still in power, standing on a tenuous coalition waiting to regain power for themselves. The economy had to be shut down for months, and that reduced Malaysia's ability to lock down again, with many businesses, especially in the tourism and entertainment industries, permanently impacted. Rampant human rights abuses of Rohingyas and other immigrants and stateless communities in Malaysia would continue to go unresolved. And of course, when the cluster was declared finished, the vaccines were still a year away. For next week though, we'll be focusing on Pakistan, where a repeat of the events in Kuala Lumpur occurred in Lahore, where a major gathering of Tablighi supporters turned into a super spreader event and forced the entirety of the country to take action in its own dramatic way. Sources for this episode can be found in the episode description. For correspondence and corrections, please message me on Twitter at polypandemicpod, that is P-O-L-I, pandemic pod. If I can make this podcast work, I would like to hear from you, your story of dealing with this pandemic, and if you have any suggestions for future topics you'd like me to look into. I apologize once again for any mistakes, truncations, and errors I may have made in the preceding episode. And as always, if you can, get yourself and everyone you know vaccinated, wear a mask if you can, and always wash your hands.